on the first Thursday of every month, first Tuesday. I used to come to those all the time just to track timber sales.
Come on, let's go.
Kind of beat that brush out.
Where's the state patrol? Well, I know we lost two. I know Dave left. I know that. Okay. Well, we're going to get started because we do have a quorum. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Yeah, I'll let the record show we have a quorum of 7. Hopefully there'll be some more filter in here. The first item on, or the next item on today's agenda is public comment on board manual sections. And if I'm looking correctly here, I see... I only picked up one of these. Arthur West, are you here? Okay, thank you. We'll have to miss that individual. The next individual that signed up on Fitzwood is Adrian Miller. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good afternoon again. I'm Adrian Miller with the Washington Forest Protection Association, and I'd just like to let you all know that WFPA does support the adoption of the fixed width buffer template. We recognize that this template only serves to address a small component of the issues the small forest landowner community has with the current rule structure. That being said, this template allows for a small forest landowner to achieve some of the benefits provided by the rules via the desired future conditions process without the inherent complexity. Specifically, the template eliminates the need to count and measure every tree in the RMZ. It also eliminates the need to enter this data into the DFC program to calculate the buffer widths. This template only requires identifying one no harvest zone on the ground, as opposed to the existing rule where you could have up to 3 zones identified on the ground. And the template also does not require measuring stream size. The template does all of this while appropriately accounting for equivalency for all stream buffer functions based on a quantitative analysis of actual buffer widths and conditions. I respectfully urge you to adopt this template as part of Board Manual 21. And thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions now or during your discussion.
Thanks, Adrian.
Welcome.
Ken Miller. Afternoon.
Good afternoon. Commissioner Goldmark and members of the board, I'm here to testify in support of the single width or single tier buffer, whatever we call it. While this template is a marginal benefit to the more skilled small landowners, I believe this will be popular with the bulk of the small landowners like myself that are not able, or in my case, inclined to learn all the technical options for one or two harvests in our lifetime. This clearly eliminates much of the complexity and will be a financial benefit to those of us that have been leaving way more trees than the current rules actually require. Attached is a copy of the regulatory section of our Washington Farm Forestry Association vision statement, where I've highlighted, I'm not going to go through all that, but the highlighted portions show you the portions of an earlier vision statement that we had done that this particular template actually addresses very well. I would point out that this template is for the west side only. We have not been able to participate in the development of this particular template, but I do wish to extend our thanks to those that have worked on this template on our behalf, particularly Adrian Miller, who just spoke, and Mark Engel. I would also like to call your attention to the rest of the WFFA regulatory vision statement that isn't highlighted, particularly the RCWs, the WACs, and the remaining low-impact management options that remain as unfulfilled promises in forest and fish. These remaining promises have heightened importance now that our state apparently doesn't have the ability to maintain their promises on the FRIP, or Forest Repairing Easement Program, or a vibrant small forest landowner office. Thank you in advance for helping us find ways to fulfill the rest of the forest and fish promises. Thank you. All right.
Thank you. Miguel? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and members of the board. Miguel Perez Gibson speaking on behalf of the Forest and Fish Caucus. I'm here speaking in support of the fix with buffer and the changes to the board manual that are going to be before you. And a couple of quick comments I want to make about the process. The Society of American Foresters has a code of ethics, and ethics number 3 is sound science is the foundation of the forestry profession. And ethic number 4 is that public policy related to forests must be based on both scientific principles and societal values. I mention those two because the group that worked on this put a lot of trust and confidence in Adrian Miller's ability to help us through this process. And he needs to be commended for the work he did and the trust that he has engendered among all the stakeholders in working with him. He does a very, very fine job. And I think this is, although it hasn't gotten a lot of spotlight, if one takes a sharp, a more comprehensive look at what this group did, this is how forest and fish is supposed to work. And it worked well. So thank you very much.
All right. Well, thank you, Miguel. I'm going to call once more for Mr. West before we close this particular part of the meeting. Okay, thank you. So the public comment period is closed now, and we'll move on to a discussion of the board manual Section 7 guidelines for riparian management zones and Section 21 guidelines for alternative plans. Gretchen Robinson and Mark, please.
Good afternoon, Commissioner and members of the board. Gretchen and I are each going to present a separate board manual section. Gretchen will present board manual section 7, which is the riparian board manual. Primary reason that we opened this section and to amend it was as a result of the DFC rulemaking. And after the board takes action on that section, then I will present the fixed width template for inclusion in board manual section 21.
Commissioner and members of the board, I am requesting your approval now of board manual section 7 guidelines for riparian management zone. It is a revised manual from what is currently in your notebooks and being used. When the board adopted the desired future condition rule in August, it became necessary to amend the board manual to reflect the 325 square foot basal area target that you adopted. But when we looked at the changes that were necessary, we also saw other improvements that could be made throughout the manual. So we asked for and received input from external partners as well as DNR region and division forest practices staff. And as I mentioned in my memorandum in your packet, we also referred to a 2007 CMER document for additional opportunities to improve the RMC manual. That was very helpful. In the end, we believe it is now it will now be easier to follow, and it offers more help for Western Washington landowners to prepare for entering their stand information, all their tree data, into the web-based desired future condition worksheet. And it provides more help for Eastern Washington landowners to calculate the interzone management opportunities that they might have. It now has new illustrations for the sensitive sites and an improved description of alluvial fans. And finally, it received Forest and Fish policy support at their January meeting. So I request your approval of this revised board manual.
We have questions from board members?
I move approval of the revised board manual.
Second.
Yeah, we have a motion properly supported to approve revision of the board manual. Discussion on the motion? Call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. All right. Let the record show that the motion was approved unanimously. Then we can go on to the second issue, Mark.
Second.
We would like to be able to make small editing changes to the manual because we already have seen a couple very small edits, nothing substantive, if that would be all right with the board.
Editorial changes only?
Yes, like where
or
instead
editing?
Of a word, something like that. Yeah.
Is that okay with the board?
Yeah.
I don't see a problem with that.
Thank you. I thank Patricia for reminding
me of that.
Thank you for checking.
Okay. Now we're going to address board manual section 21. And I added this little comment, and I think it's really important to point out that for the fixed width template was developed as a result of a proposal initiation request from the board to the Adaptive Management Program last spring. And the policy accepted the request from the board. They did put together a two-step approach, the first step of which was to create the fixed width template. And they assembled a subgroup which in very short order prepared this template. I'd like to point out, however, that policy has added to its work list completion of the second step, which is to evaluate, develop, and present to the board potential fixed width riparian buffer rules to be applied to all forest landowners. That step is still before policy, and that will ultimately fulfill the request from the board, though we're not ready for that at this time. The policy subgroup developed for board's consideration this template. It has been received policy support at the January meeting. Stephen, coming up there, if you want to add anything to that.
Sure.
Okay.
All right, a couple of things I want to point out. One is, it was an excellent subgroup. Of course, I chaired it. I want to point out a couple of things. There's a couple of reasons this group worked really well together. One of them was because of Adrian, as a couple of other speakers have pointed out. Another was because we were able to use a large data set that we haven't had before. And although it took a long time to get through the DFC rulemaking process, the process that was gone through this summer to do the analysis created this data set that we could then use to do the analysis. And that was the work that mostly Adrian Miller did, along with guidance from the subcommittee. And that made it very efficient. Everybody had a lot of confidence in that work that was done this last summer on DFC, and then we were able to reuse it. So I just want to make sure that everybody understands we've had two adaptive management little processes here in quick fashion that has worked. and we've been able to bring things back to the board.
So you want more, right?
What's next, huh?
Well, Stephen stole most of my comments, but that's okay. He was the chair of the committee. Again, I also want to thank Adrian. It was a pleasure working with him. And the board was provided an explanation on how we conducted the analysis and how we arrived at the fixed width by site class. So some key points to the template. It was written to be easily understood and simple to apply on the ground. The fixed width buffers are based on site class and start from the outer edge of bank full width or the channel migration zone. We do not have the two stream sizes in this template. We also did invite the small forest landowners to participate in the subgroup. They were unable to attend the subgroup meetings. However, they were emailed all of the information that all the group received. We also presented to the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee. We presented them the analysis, and then we later presented to them the template for their review. So they did have opportunity to see what we were developing and make comment on it. With that, I will entertain any questions.
Questions from board members? Norm?
Am I correct in reading, Mark, that essentially the new part of the manual is, starts on page 15? It's indicated as a new template and goes from there until the end of 16, and everything else is there is the same as it's previously been.
Okay. Yeah, that's correct.
Great. Thank you.
This is by far and away the longest template we've ever written. It was, we have included it. It will become the second template.
Sarah, I can imagine you have a question or two.
No, no questions, just comments. Truly, you did follow this board's request, and I really appreciate the time spent by everyone, including, especially Edward. It just kind of shows you can get it done when you want to get it done, can't you? Quickly. I like that kind of attitude. Just get her done.
Other comments or questions? Proposed action?
Motion to accept the template.
Second.
Go ahead. Okay. Motion properly supported to accept the template as presented.
Mark?
Could we request that you allow us to make appropriate edits?
Sure.
As necessary.
Right.
See, Adrian came through, I think.
Might change that 101 to 100.
Discussion on the motion. I just like to compliment the effort. I know that expectations were high, and I think you've delivered to get this back in a reasonable time frame. And we appreciate very much your hard work. And I guess at this point, I'd like to call for a vote. All those in favor, raise your hand. Thank you. Let the record show the vote was unanimous. And thanks again for your help, Sharon.
I do think it is important to note, though, that the template certainly saves the small landowner sometimes in the simplicity of the layout, but it certainly has not yet addressed the disproportionate impact. We still are needing function and protections, as the data show. So we want to keep that in mind as we move forward also. That's a good job.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen. Moving on then to the last item, finally, on today's agenda. Mr. Bernath, you can come back. We're going to talk about your Clean Water Act assurances.
So, for the record, I'm Stephen Bernath, Forest Policy Lead for the Department of Ecology. And with me is
Mark Hicks, also with the Department of Ecology.
And Mark, we're going to do two things for you this afternoon. The agenda didn't quite reflect that, but as I requested the last meeting, we want to give you a quarterly update on how we're doing on the milestones for clean water assurances, and Mark is here to actually do that for you. And then the other thing we're going to do, as requested by the commissioner, was explain what the water quality standards are. And we're going to do a quick run-through of those in relationship to temperature and turbidity. It's nice to have Mark here, which I didn't have at the last meeting, because he actually wrote the standards and lived through like a 10-15 year process to get where we are now. So he's actually the expert.
Yeah, it's a nice change in roles, actually.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm going to start, since the microphone's facing me, I'm going to start with the update on how we're doing with meeting the Clean Water Act assurances milestones. As I hope you all recall, back in October, we provided a formal decision that we were going to extend the Clean Water Act protections, we call them assurances, to the Forest Practices Program, contingent on meeting some formal milestones of program improvement and accomplishment that had some very date certain timelines associated with them. And so we've committed to come back at every quarter and give you just kind of an update on how that's going, and make sure that if something's going wrong, that you have an early heads up about it and maybe can weigh in. I have to say, though, although most of the issues are about a month or 2 months behind their scheduled dates, DNR has really stepped forward and offered up the management and staff necessary and structure to get things now rolling at a real rapid pace. So we're really moving on trying to get all the milestones accomplished that were listed for 2009 that weren't accomplished yet, and then in 2010. So although we are behind schedule, it looks like we'll catch up with those dates before the end of this year. And I consider that to be a really good thing. And I really do want to commend DNR and their staff for taking a real positive attitude and trying to find good ways to resolve this as close to those milestone dates as possible. So I want to make sure that I say that. DNR has assigned project managers and project leads to all the key milestone categories. And that has been very successful in splitting up this large workload among their staff and being able to then move all the small committees necessary to make forward progress on those. So that's been really a good thing. We do still have some concerns. There are still some milestones, in spite of all that good work, that are going to drag a lot farther than we would like. We haven't figured out how to resolve those yet. Some of them have technical issues associated with them that are hung up in the CEMA process, such as the hardwood conversion temperature study that the CEMA scientific advisory group essentially rejected the analysis that was first developed for it. And they're going back to the drawing board to see how to move it forward. And that's going to take probably quite a few more months to figure out. It turned out it was a far more difficult study because of the sites that were selected and handed to CEMA for analysis. And we may have to kind of break the mold for how we normally do these experimental study analyses to be able to provide that kind of a, get some good solid data and findings for those study sites. So we don't know where that's going to end up. So that's kind of a, we're not sure where that's going, but Ecology is very much engaged in that, and I think we'll be satisfied with where it ends up before it's all done. Our biggest concern really is about the long-term budget for the Adaptive Management Program. This is no surprise to you, but you know, we think we're going to be okay for 2010, but until we can find some new sources of funding, the long-term future of the Adaptive Management Program looks pretty bleak in terms of being able to meet those Clean Water Act milestones. But overall, things are going really well.
Any questions for Mark on the update on milestones? Okay, so let's talk about water quality standards. And I want to take you to what Mark is, I won't tell you what Mark is calling this diagram, but Just a reminder that this is that Clean Water Act is a circular process. At the top of that process is where it all begins, and that's each state in the union adopts standards to determine if waters are impaired or not. And so that's what we're going to talk about today. So standards basically define the goals for water bodies by designating the beneficial uses for those waters and establishing the criteria to protect those uses. So, and then if for some reason those waters aren't meeting those needs, that results in TMDLs or other actions to bring them back into line. So in 2003 and 2006, we adopted new criteria for temperature. I won't talk to you about ammonia and or bacteria, but those were also included in the rule adoption process ecology did at that time. We also established a new anti-degradation implementation plan, and we restructured the way water quality standards are seen when you go to that rule, and I'll explain that in a minute. So here's sort of we're on our way to the big bottom line here. Under the old classification system, there was basically two or three temperatures you could keep in your head. And basically in the upper watershed waters, the expectation was to have 16 degrees C. And then as you move down through the watershed, it was 18, and then down towards the bottom, depending on the uses that were associated with, went up to 21. We switched that to designating those waters based on the uses that are present in each of those waters. And generally, the uses in those waters are around fish, and they're the most conservative, I don't know if that's the right
sensitive
word. Sensitive, thank you, that's the word. Sensitive, and so temperature becomes a big driver on whether waters are meeting clean water standards. And so the criteria you see before you, char, as in bull trout, need 12 degrees C, and the measurement is a 7-day average daily maximum temperature. For salmon and trout spawning, 16 salmon and trout spawning, non-core rearing, and I'll let Mark explain what that means if you have a question about it, about 17.5. We got rearing waters at 17.5, and then we have some warm water fish or red band trout designations. Do you want to add anything to that? Okay. One of the other things that was included in the new standards criteria was sometimes if you have an annual basically temperature standards such as the ones in the previous thing like that. Doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get cold enough for during spawning season. And so we have the supplemental criteria for early spawning and during the merging of the eggs of 9 degrees for bull trout and for salmon at 13. Correct?
That's correct. So basically the way this was set up is that some of these stocks of salmon and steelhead, they actually spawn so early into the fall that it's very close to the summer peak temperature season. Others actually don't even emerge. The eggs and the fry don't emerge until late into the spring, also when water is already beginning to warm up. And so these criteria are put into those waters where that kind of a use occurs to provide a little extra protection. So these criteria, the 9 and the 13 degree, apply in addition to the one Stephen was talking about before. So we have the summer maximum temperature criteria that might be 16 or 17.5. And then we also have these seasonal criteria that are 9 and 13.
And what time are we talking about here? What, what time in the fall?
Those are all specified in our state water quality standards for each individual river based okay. on the documented
What's the
presence.
Range, though?
They can be as early as August 1st for the 13 degree salmon criteria, and including actually I think even the char is almost that early in some
watershed.
That
would probably be at higher elevation though?
Most of the bull trout tend to be at the higher elevations. The actual salmon spawning, like for Chinook and such, no, it can be at high and low. They're spread out quite wide.
So it's going to require real special habitat to require that temperature.
Yes, it has to be suitable habitat. They're quite capable of using a wide range of habitat because we have so many different species of salmonids that they all have a different preference. And so it covers a pretty broad range out there on the landscape.
So one of the things I'll do is I'm going to just pass this around to the board members. I didn't bring copies for everybody, but this is just an illustration of a map that's out of our standards that shows where some of these special designations are. So in this case, Commissioner, this is up in the Wenatchee Wire 45, and there's a whole bunch of reaches that have this special designation, and I'll just pass this around to the board members. At the end of the presentation, I'll show you the website you can go to find all this information.
Yes, question, Norm.
Are those designations then based on the actual presence of those particular stocks in those particular stream or stream reaches, or is it potential?
No,
it's actually on presence. We actually had to do a second pool making that helped us work with the tribes and State Fish and Wildlife to make sure we had good data.
The one caveat is that the bull trout layer is a more of a modeled approach.
Thank you. So the other piece here is what happens if temperature criteria cannot be met naturally. For water bodies that naturally do not meet the criteria, the target changes to just allowing a small change from what it is capable of meeting. The big difference between where we were some time ago and now is using the anti-degradation criteria in combination with all these temperature criteria. There are three tiers of protection. Fully protecting existing use is tier one. Tier two is ensuring waters that are below criteria, basically, and making sure they are protected as well. So in other words, just because, say, a water body has a standard of 16 degrees C doesn't mean that you can allow degradation if it's 14 degrees currently up to 16. It means you have to protect that clean pool water as well. And then there is a outstanding resource waters criteria in tier three. So tier one is basically applying the criteria I talked about earlier. And if those waters don't meet that criteria, then we need to use TMDLs or other BMPs to bring those waters into compliance. Tier two, again, is where we allow some degradation, but not a lot. In other words, if you have clean water already or better than standards water, then you're only allowed to degrade it a small amount, not 2 or 3 degrees. And that becomes really important, particularly in upper watersheds, if you want to continue to produce clean, cool water for fish and other uses. And then tier three, and I'll let, do you mind explaining tier three?
EPA regulations established these anti-degradation requirements. They wanted to make sure that every state had a category of protection it could place its most precious waters into, essentially a preservation category that would preserve them long into the future at their existing high quality level. High quality in the context of this program isn't just water quality, it also has to do with other ecological features and recreational use. It's a broader concept. It's basically, if you've got some of the nation's treasures in your state and you choose to put it in a non-degradation category, we want to really be able to protect you. So they ask every state to create this anti-degradation program within their water quality standards. They can take different shapes, but that's basically what they were after. Our anti-degradation tier 3, which there are no waters that have been put into the category yet, we've only created the category, actually has an A and B part. The A part says there'll be no degradation whatsoever. That's one choice we can make. Then there's a second choice that's a little less stringent, and it's basically that the degradation cumulatively has to be below what you would be able to detect, below a statistical detection limit, essentially. Gives a little bit more room for some minor effects of human activities. But essentially, this is a nomination process. You go through a rulemaking, and the rulemaking has to actually result in naming that water body in our water quality standards under Tier 3. This could be national and state parks, wildlife, refuges, that sort of thing. Wild and scenic rivers. But again, none exist at this point.
Could it be just a segment of a river?
It could be just a segment of a river, but there are eligibility requirements to be able to manage it at this non-degradation state that might make it difficult to take, for example, the lowest 1 mile segment of a river and put it in this category.
Going back to the tier two, can you guys provide just an example of what would be, for the exceptions, what would be necessary or considered an overriding public interest?
Well, the water quality standards regulation goes through that kind of a process. And really where we try to focus, because the overriding public interest part is a, if you will, a squishy concept. It is kind of a little bit of in the eye of the beholder, but we're going to weigh all the various features, economic and social, in trying to come to that test. But because that is a more difficult test to really say you made it or didn't make it, we set our program up so it's more focused on the alternatives, that you've done a real thorough evaluation of non-degrading or less degrading alternatives. And that's where the punch is for our program.
So back to the Tier 3, you say you don't have any current candidates for this?
That's correct.
So talk to us about why, say, the upper reach of the Stehekin River. Is that something that...
We are waiting for people to actually nominate water bodies. We have been in conversations with various groups who have shown some interest, but I've been a little away from the standards the last few years. But to my knowledge, that has never progressed to a full request for consideration yet. Some of these rivers clearly could qualify without a doubt.
What would be the purpose of a group approaching you about such a classification? Would it be to protect their interest in the water, or what's the outcome that they would be seeking?
Well, I think for a lot of folks, it's basically recognizing that these waters are very special and that they want to preserve them at that level.
Okay, thank you.
So the other thing I just wanted to point out, I mentioned it earlier, is that our standards have been restructured from the old class system to use-based. So if you, and this goes back to Board Member Shaw's question about whether it's based mostly on fish presence or the specific species, for example, and the answer is, for the most part, is yes, because if fish are present in a particular water body, then at a specific species, particularly identified in the criteria, then that criteria apply to that water body. So how does this relate to what we do? One of the things I asked CEMER in particular to do after we had adopted the new standards, and what I know that Mark does as being ecology's representative on CEMER on a regular basis now, is as we design studies, it's important that they are using, that they have knowledge about the current standards, so that when we look at whether the rules are effective, that we have the right methodology in place so that we can clearly say when we come to the board whether a rule is effective at protecting clean water or not. The other thing, as you know, every time board member Lowry takes a vote on this board, he needs to be in agreement that the rules that you adopt are going to meet the intent of either protecting or restoring water quality in the forest. And so we work hard with him at the staff level back at ecology to make sure that that occurs so that he can, with a clear conscience vote and support the rulemaking efforts that come forward at this board. And remember, all the asterisk rules in the forest practice rules are in some way related to clean water, and you have to have agreement from the ecology in order to actually move those rules forward. And then back to board member Jackson's comment, there are, if there was a situation, we prefer it not to happen, where we had to do a tier two anti-degradation analysis, then that would be something in addition we would do as part of the rulemaking process. So we will continue to work with CEMER to make sure their methodologies actually reflect the current water quality standards. When we're measuring whether we're getting clean water as a result of the rules, and we'll continue, of course, to work with you under the new standards to make sure that rules and board manuals are consistent with protecting and restoring water quality. Any questions? And there's our website. You can go there and it'll flip you to the actual rules. What I had hoped, and we're not quite there yet, but we do have maps for the special criteria, for the spawning criteria, and if you have GIS software on your computer, you can get to a map of the standards, but we don't have it quite yet on the website where anybody can look at it that way.
Brad?
So if they don't meet water temperature requirements, then so what do they have to do? Do they have to plant trees, or what do they do to meet those requirements?
Let me go back to the beginning. So
truck in ice.
Truck in ice. Yeah.
So remember how we got started on this conversation, and I presented the most recent assessment, the 2008 assessment, to you at the last meeting, and that's this second box clockwise from the top, where we identify which waters meet water quality standards based on the monitoring that we have or that people give us. And that determines basically our work list in cleaning up waters of the state. And that list gets prioritized. And so for outside of forest land, a TMDL is basically done. A total maximum daily load or a cleanup plan is identified. And then we work through, whether it's permitted facilities, to make sure that there's reductions associated with the permits to meet water quality standards, or in the case of Nonpoint, we work with landowners to put BMPs in place so that there is less pollution, and therefore hopefully moving towards having meeting water quality. So did that answer your question?
No.
All right.
Well, how do they reduce the temperature of the water?
Oh. That depends on what it is. Steve actually kind of touched on that. I mean, if it's an industry discharging hot water from processes that they have within their factory, it might be one set of solutions, a technologically based set of solutions. It could be part passive cooling, some active cooling, like evaporative cooling equipment. So that would be like a discharge pipe going into the water with hot, or into a stream with hot water.
Sure.
So that's different than when we get into the non-point source world, where you know, the board has most of its work. In agriculture, it often includes putting setbacks away from the stream to regrow trees and other vegetation that'll shade and cool the water down. In forestry, though, what we set up were those Clean Water Act assurances. That's what those are all about. They take the place of the TMDL on this wheel that Stephen put up on the board, where we're basically relying on the adaptive management program to keep refining those rules until they reach the point that we can have confidence that they won't cause violations of the water quality standards.
So in other words, the repairing requirements that you all have adopted are intended to bring those waters that currently may be warmer than they need to be. As shade regrows, hopefully we'll see those waters come back into compliance with water quality standards. And that's what CEMER is trying to do, is to determine whether our current rules are effective.
Thank you.
Yes, Anna.
Just to follow up on the commissioner's question about the Tier 3 special waters, or whatever we want to call them, does Ecology have any plans to do a little bit more public outreach on, I'm just not sure how many people are aware that maybe, you know, you're waiting for certain water bodies to be nominated or working with interest groups, citizen groups, and if that's a really long answer, you can...
I think it'll be a short answer, really, I'm afraid. Okay. It's a sorry, sad answer. No. When we were adopting the standards, both in 2003 and then when they were updated in 2006, that included this anti-degradation package of rules, we were all around the state. I think we probably did typically, each time we went out, we probably did about 7 meeting locations around the state. And this was a prominent feature there. But since that time, no, we really haven't reached out to anybody and said anything yet. And part of that, though, this is the sad part, part of that was basically losing staff. And in the budget conditions that have happened within our program before the big downturn, and then now with we're all in this little bucket together, those staff really weren't rehired, and there wasn't the ability to go out there and reach out. I know that the staff now are working on their long-term plans for what they're going to be doing in regards to the standards, what outreach, what initiatives they're going to try to highlight in their public meetings. But I haven't been that involved with them lately, so I don't know if this is on their near-term agenda.
Questions? Norm?
You focused here on temperature requirements. Is there a similar turbidity set of standards?
Yes. Basically, there's a turbidity standard that says you need to keep waters within 5 NTUs above background. And 5 NTUs is just a unit of clarity through a clear sample. And it's not very much. I mean, basically, if you can see a plume in a stream, you've exceeded that standard. And that's why we've encouraged, let me just say, what that means on the ground. For example, he was a representative of a landowner out there, board member shop, is when you're out there, if you've got a plume of water, of dirty water going in a creek, and you can see a difference between up above where that plume is occurring and below, you're probably out of compliance, both with water quality standards or with the fact that you either don't have some BMPs in place that you need to have in place to prevent that from occurring. And as you know, the road rules are performance-based, and they function a lot around this standard.
So in other words, if I may, then it's not a strict numerical standard, because streams change throughout the season. At one time of the year, they're naturally going to be carrying more sediment. At another time of the year, they're going to be carrying less sediment. And so it's the difference between the receiving water and the delivering water at that point in time. Is that
correct?
More or less correct?
Correct.
Thank you.
Other questions from the board? All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for your presentation. That completes our agenda for today. There being no further business to come before the board, we are adjourned.
All right. All right.